to be an Al-Anon and an alcoholic. And so Ned is going to come up and introduce our Al-Anon speaker.
Very good.
My name's that I'm an alcoholic and I'm an Al-Anon. So I went on both sides, don't I? We are in for a real treat today. Both the speakers are outstanding. The young lady I'm going to introduce is beautiful on the inside as well as the outside. And I should tell you her story. It's certainly a rewarding thing to listen to. We go to a Saturday morning together, and when I get out of line, she gives me this look like she does her boss. Should maybe tell you about her boss. She gives me that look too. And so when she does this, I know sort of like my wife does too. You know, so anyway, without further ado, I'd like to bring Judy up for her talk.
Hey, Judy.
Hi, everybody. My name is Judy. And I am a grateful and recovering member of Al-Anon Family Groups. And somebody asked me if I was nervous about speaking. I said no, but I am nervous about what Ned might say. Thank you, Ned. That was a very kind introduction. And I want to leave Glenn lots of time, so I'm going to jump right in quickly on my story. I began my trip to emotional sobriety on February 3rd, 1998. It was a Tuesday 5:30 meeting. It was myself and three black belt Al-Anons, one that's sitting right here in the second row, Henry O. He's been a big part of my story. And of course, the lovely Sylvia. I always say that Sylvia is the kind of woman that I aspire to be. I'm not there yet, but I'm getting there. So it was me and three black belts. I came here very, very broken and very angry. I had two emotions, anger and sadness, pretty much. My marriage was ending to the man I'd been with since I was 14. I met him when I was 14, started dating him when I was 15, married him when I was 16 because I got pregnant, had my daughter when I was 17. We'd been married 20 years. He didn't want to be married anymore. He was an alcoholic. The drinking had progressed. Everything was just bad. I had no idea really who I was, what I wanted, what I was going to do. I was full of fear, financial fear, all kinds of fear, really, and I was angry. You know, I shared in the Saturday meeting a couple weeks ago, when I was married, I was just so angry all the time. And he had a felony conviction from when he was younger from having some marijuana, and he couldn't buy a gun. And he always wanted me to buy a gun so we could have a gun in the house for protection. And I would think, fool, if you knew how bad you piss me off, there is no way in hell you would want a firearm in this house. And I wouldn't do it. I never would do it because I knew I was so angry that if I did it, he would come home drunk one night, and at some point I would draw it on him. And I didn't know if I would have the courage to pull the trigger, but I thought it'd just be better that we not find that out. So I jumped right into the program. You know, I was there with these three black belt Al-Anons. They shared their experience, strength, and hope. One of them became my sponsor, the lovely Barbara A. I will love that woman forever. She's kind and loving. She was always just so good to me, and she loved me when I did not have a clue what it meant to love yourself. And I will forever, ever be grateful for her and love her. And so I got a sponsor. Y'all gave me a formula for life that I still use today, and that is show up, do the next right thing, go to meetings, talk to people, pray. Over and over. Show up, do the next right thing, go to meetings, talk to people, pray. And that formula has served me through many things in my life, and I still use it today. About 2 months into my separation from the alcoholic, I remember one day I went to work and I had a big meeting that day. And it was a meeting, a level of meeting that I wasn't normally included in. So I put on my very best blue business suit, my navy blue pumps, and I was, you know, dressed for business. I came home from work that day. The meeting was a success. I came home from work that day to open the mail and buy the credit card bill. My alcoholic and I had been separated probably about 2 to 3 months. I'd been in the program 2 to 3 months. I find this credit card bill, and there's a list of things on there for a woman that I knew I didn't get. Now, our marriage had been a series of infidelity. You know, he was always skirting around behind my back. I got really angry, and I decided I was going to go confront him. He was living in an apartment complex, but I didn't know what apartment was his. Now, I work in the car business, and before we separated, things had been going pretty well for a while. He needed a truck, and I was able to get a really good deal on a truck. I bought him a truck, and a Ford F-150 pickup truck. And the paint was really oxidized on it, so I was able to get a good deal on it, because they can't put cars like that on the lot and resell them. So then the guys at the body shop said they would paint it for me. Now, because I take care of people's paychecks, that's my job, you know, people tend to want to do things for you. So they painted this truck. It was like a factory paint job, candy apple red, and one of the guys even pinstriped it for me for free. I got the truck painted really cheap, so I gave it to him. And then for Christmas, it was Christmas time, so I bought him a bed liner for it for his Christmas present, so he was set. So shortly after that, in late January, February, we separated for like, I don't know, third or fourth time. We were always, you know, splitting up, getting together, splitting up, getting back together. It was a very addictive relationship. So I was mad because I got this credit card bill, so I just thought I was going to go confront him. So I went over to the apartment complex that I knew he was living in, but I didn't know what apartment was his. And so I kind of, you know, hung around, hoping he was going to come out, because, you know, I mean, I was so addicted to him that any interaction I needed, even if it was a negative interaction, you know, I mean, that's how addictive relationships are. He never did come out, but there was the truck. And my keys were in my hand. So I proceeded to just key every inch of that truck that I could. And at one point, I'm in a navy blue business suit, 4-inch heels. I am on all fours on the hood of this truck, scratching the paint off of it. And it's not an easy thing to do, but I learned I'm pretty strong. Because I took that thing all the way down to the metal. Up to that point, you know, when I got to the rooms of Al-Anon, I had no issue accepting step one, none whatsoever, because I knew I was powerless. I knew I had tried everything in my power to get that man to stop drinking. But step two I had a problem with, because it said we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Us? Well, there ain't nothing wrong with me. You know, I'm the one holding everything together. I'm the one taking care of business. I'm the one trying to keep this thing together. If you would just tell me how to make him stay in line, straighten up, and fly right, you know, I could be out of here. We could get this thing done. There was nothing wrong with me. But people tell me, don't worry about step two. You're not there yet. So I took that advice. But where it hit me, where I had my step two moment, was driving back from that incident. He never did come out. So I'm in the car. I'm thinking about what I did. I'm speeding down 410. I'm crying hysterically. And I had a moment of clarity. Oh, we, us. This is what they're talking about. I'm crazy. When did I become this? When did I become this person? When did I become this Jerry Springer episode? And I knew then that it wasn't just about him, you know, that I had a part in this. And I went in the house and I called my sponsor and I told her what I did. And she talked me through it. And from that point, we moved on. And I just continued to work that formula, show up, do the next right thing, go to meetings, talk to people, pray. And little by little, my life got better. I had a lot of financial fear because I had, you know, it was a two-income household, and I had the lesser of the two incomes. And now he was gone. I had myself. I had my daughter. I wasn't even sure I could keep a roof over our heads. She had just started college, and she was counting on me to pay for it. And so one day, I just got in the living room on my knees, in a chair, facing a chair, and said, you know, God, there's more going out than there is coming in. I don't know how I'm going to do this. I'm going to try to work this program and work these steps. I have a lot on my plate right now, and I just have to trust you with everything else. And I can tell you that things just started to happen for me. I would get money in the mail. That's one way it looked. I could have an escrow overage. I'd get a check in the mail. I'd be worried, how am I going to pay for my daughter's textbooks? I would get a check, or I would get an opportunity. Sometimes it looked like an opportunity where my job would say, well, we've sold 4 dealerships in Austin. We need somebody to go up there and close out the final payrolls. And if you'll go, we'll bonus you. And I'd say, sure, I'll go. Now, a bonus could have been $100 for all I knew, but it was $100 more than I had. And I would just go. But, you know, it would turn out to be $800 or $1,000. Or they would say, you know, the owner's having a cattle auction and he needs somebody to go Saturday and sit in the office and just collect the money. He'll bonus you, I'd say. Okay, I'll go. Not knowing what it was going to pay. The owner would come in his Texas draw, would pull out a lot of money and say, thank you, darling. Peel off $600 bills and hand it to me. So that was $600 tax-free money. So all kinds of things like that.
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
So then they started closing the offices of all the dealerships and deciding that my office was going to be the main office. And so I would get raised every time they would do that. And they decided they're going to have a centralized office, and it was the office that I worked in. And in 6 years at the same job, my income doubled. My responsibilities quadrupled, but I've never been afraid of hard work. I had a neighbor that used to say I was a worker bee. And so I just stuck with the program, and things just happened. And, you know, a lot of times it felt like nothing was happening. And I cried a lot of tears, but they were healing tears. And I used to come to the Saturday meeting and go home and just work in my yard and cry and talk to God. But I had a lot of pain inside of me that needed to come out. And I had a sponsee recently say to me, you know, I'm trying to do this four-step, but every time I start, I just start to cry. And I said, well, cry. You know, you need to cry. There's a lot of pain in you. There's nothing wrong with tears. They're very healing. And she said, well, I was hoping you would say, that means I'm just not ready. I said, no, I'm not going to say that. If you need to cry, you cry, but just keep going. So I think that's important, too. You know, we need to heal. And so life just got better. It got better and better for me. My life today is really good. About 5 years after my divorce, I have to share this part of my story because it's an important one, but not a very pretty one. My daughter had become very angry and kind of bitter towards me, and I really didn't know what was going on. And finally, at one point she called me, and she just picked a fight over the phone. And when we hung up, I immediately called my sponsor. I said, I don't know what happened. I feel like I was attacked. And she said, well, just leave her alone. Just leave her alone now. This is my only child, and we always had a relationship, so it was really hard for me to leave her alone. But I did. I left her alone for about 3 months. And finally, she contacted me and confessed to me that from the time she was 12 to 15, her father, my ex-husband, had been attempting to sexually molest her. And he had been exposing himself to her and just doing a lot of really awful things. But she had started having anxiety attacks. And after a couple trips to the emergency room, the doctor finally told her, look, there's no physical reason for this. I would suggest you see a therapist. And she started to see a therapist and was starting to work for it. Well, I had no idea that was going on. But I can tell you this. I've done a lot of work around it. You know, for a long time I said, why didn't she tell me? Because I did all the things that mothers do. You know, if anybody touches you, this is a good touch, this is a bad touch. You know, even if it's your father, never dreaming it's going to be her father. You know, you have to tell me. I had told her all that. But what I finally realized through my own therapy was that the reason she didn't tell me was because she knew that it probably wasn't going to make any difference. I was not leaving that man. And I have to own that today, and that's hard for me. And I've had to make amends to her for that. And we did work through it. But I have to talk about that today. You know, it's not a popular topic, and it can bring a meeting to a grinding halt. You can hear a pin drop if you bring that subject up. But there's a lot of people out there with these stories. And the way we get through them is we shine the light on them. And we have to talk about them. Predators and pedophiles are successful because we keep their secrets. And I'm not going to keep that secret today, so I have to tell you that part of my story. It's an important part. But she and I, we worked through it. Therapy for me is a big part of my story too, because I didn't know how to forgive myself for that. I really didn't. And I needed help with that. And I'm really glad that I did it. I remember it was actually my friend Benny P, who's here somewhere, who one day I said to him, I don't know why I can't meet somebody and just be happy, because I'm a nice person and I'm, relatively attractive, and I don't know, men just aren't interested in me. And, he just so sweetly took my hand and said, because you've been traumatized and you don't let anybody in. And he was right. So that was another reason that I had to do therapy. So I found a 12-step in therapist, and it was really just more fourth-step work. That's exactly the way I treated it. It was just more fourth-step work. And again, I would show up, do the next right thing, go to the meeting, talk to her, and pray. And it's gotten me through a lot of things. My life today is really, really good. So let me share a little bit about what it's like today. Financial freedom. I know that today. I no longer have financial fear. And I'll share with you, 5 years ago, I had lived in this little house, the house that I got in my divorce, but the neighborhood was really getting pretty dicey, and I really wanted to live in another neighborhood. But see, I kind of had this messed up idea as a woman that I really, all I had to do was maintain, because someday he would come, and he would offer me the nicer things in life. Well, I had to realize that that was bullshit. That if I am really a woman in recovery, I have to be self-supporting through my own voluntary contributions. So if there's something I want, then I need to set the goal and I need to work for it. And so 5 years ago, I bought a second house and I rent out my old house, and I live in a much nicer neighborhood. But that is the program, the promises coming true for me, as they could for you. And that was also me letting go of that false belief that because I'm a woman, somebody should do it for me. And there's probably some women here that don't want to hear that today. It's the truth, I got to tell you. Life today is just really good. I have a beautiful granddaughter that is just the joy of my life. We were at the picnic court the other day, and she leans over to me and says, "Mimi, I just love spending time with you." And I was just like, oh, okay, well, here's my credit card, baby. What store do you want to go to next? I have a relationship with my daughter, a really good relationship. Today she tells me, "Mom, you're my best friend." And that wasn't always the case. Life is still life. Things happen. A few years ago, I had a really tough year. I bought that house. I moved into that house. I became a landlord for the first time. That was an adventure. As I was moving into that house, it turns out my daddy was having minor heart attacks. We buried my mother after a long illness of 3.5 years. My dad needed bypass surgery. About 90 days after we buried my mother, my father was saying he was in love. I got in my first romantic relationship in years and got my heart broke. And it was a tough year. And I think back and say, well, how did I get through that? But you know what? I just did that formula of show up, do the next right thing, go to meetings, talk to people, pray, and it'll get you through it. Life is still life, but it's still life. But I'm very happy to be here today. And if you're new, keep coming back. And I would say to you, there is a higher power. I call him God. I don't think he really cares what you call him. If you take one step towards him, he'll come running to you. He certainly did for me. But he's a gentleman. He doesn't go where he's not invited. He doesn't go where he's not wanted. He's waiting for you to invite him and be humble and surrender. And take instruction from people. There were lots of times when I would get off the phone with my sponsor and go, "She just doesn't get it." But, I was the one that didn't get it. This program really does work. I'm a poster child for the promises, so I'm just a simple gal from South Texas. I don't have any real wisdom for you other than show up, do the next right thing, go to meetings, talk to people, pray. Thanks for letting me share.